This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Jordan Osserman, your loyal host for today, and with today's episode, I'm excited to be inaugurating a new series for our podcast focused on psychoanalysis and time. So I'm producing this series of interviews in collaboration with Waiting Times, a multi-stranded research project on the temporalities of healthcare. Waiting Times is funded by the Wellcome Trust and takes place across Birkbeck, which is in the University of London, and the University of Exeter. Our project investigators are Lisa Beretzer and Laura Salisbury, and I'm personally a postdoctoral researcher on a strand of the project called The Psychic Life of Time, based in the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck. You can learn more about this project by visiting whatareyouwaitingfor.org.uk or follow us on the Twitter at whatiswaiting. So for the first episode of this new series, I'm delighted to be speaking to Chenyang Wang about his brand new book entitled Subjectivity in Between Times, Exploring the Notion of Time in Lacan's Work. Chenyang Wang is a postdoctoral fellow at East China Normal University, Shanghai. His research interests include psychoanalytic theory, gender studies, and continental philosophy. And Chenyang and I were colleagues in psychosocial studies at Birkbeck while we were completing our PhDs. We were both supervised by Stephen Frosch, who organized monthly meetings for his supervisees to discuss our work together, which is how we discovered our shared interest in Lacan and got to know one another. Chenyang received his PhD from psychosocial studies at Birkbeck in 2018. So Chenyang, thank you so much for agreeing to join us.
Hi, Jordan. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so could you begin just by telling us about your own interest in Lacan and psychoanalysis and what brought this book about?
Well, I think I became interested in psychoanalysis first during my undergraduate years at Beijing. I majored in sociology and I read broadly on topics related to critical theory, gender studies, and psychology as well. But in fact, I didn't find Freud's work or psychoanalysis in general very interesting at the beginning because all the conventional interpretations that I came across. It was not until my familiarity with Zizek and some other postmodern French thinker that I began to re-examine psychoanalysis from a different perspective. And I began to saw its potential to respond to important social, philosophical, and political problems. And in terms of how this book comes about and how I started this project, I think it comes when I first come across many interesting arguments about memory, history, sexual development, and the temporal movement in Lacan's work. So for me, it's clear that Lacan has said quite a lot about time, but no one has yet provided a very systematic examination of this topic in Lacan's work. So my project, therefore, I believe serves two purposes. One is to provide a theory of time that helps us understand Lacan's key ideas and themes, in particular, his theorization of subjectivity. The second is to make an original contribution to the continental philosophy of time that is able to provide some meaningful answers to the question of the temporal nature of our life, the meaning of the world, the body, and the language.
Okay, that's really great, and we'll delve into the themes of the book in a second. But I'm just curious a bit more about. So you grew up in China and did your undergraduate in Beijing, and then you came to the UK to do your postgraduate degree. What is the reception of psychoanalysis like in China right now? Because I imagine a lot of our listeners would be very curious to learn about that.
Yes. In my own understanding, I think in China today, I would say that psychoanalysis is quite well received as a therapeutic technique at this moment. And many articles or research I come across are talking about China is one of the most promising markets for psychoanalytic practitioners. And many foreign organizations, including the British Psychoanalytic Society, have sent their experts and analysts to China to help teaching and training Chinese people. One reason for the growing of this market in China, I believe, is that there are dramatic demand for mental health services. And the reason for that may be because of the general improvement of people's life, but also the high pressure of modern life and its conflict with the traditional Chinese social and family values, which only becomes evident in contemporary societies. So I can see a lot of my friends and colleagues go to universities and training organizations in order to find some solutions to help these people who are suffering through psychoanalysis. But another problem I want to mention is that although their psychoanalysis is welcomed as therapeutic techniques, there is not enough effort to produce a psychoanalytically informed analysis to know the social and cultural issues behind the current sufferings, which is maybe a blind spot that I believe Lacanian psychoanalysis and psychosocial studies can really help us to understand those social, cultural, political backgrounds that produce those anxieties or uncertainties.
And so how do you find the being someone who's working on Lacan in a kind of philosophical, psychosocial register, is that something that you find people are receptive to in, for example, the university where you work?
I think in the university I'm working and in relation with my current supervisors, I think they find this approach is quite innovative and quite interesting, although they don't have much experience doing research in the similar field, but they would encourage me to continue these approaches and maybe divide some interactions with their traditional philosophical inquiries and help to build an interdisciplinary environment where we can try to understand those traditional philosophical problems from different perspectives. So I think these psychosocial disciplines, although it's not fully developed in China, but it may have a much promising future in China as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it sounds like you're in something of a pioneering role then.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, well, let's go into the book. Very broadly speaking, I think one of the key issues in the book is that you challenge the idea of our maybe common sense way of thinking about time as a kind of linear thing from past to present to future. So what do you think is the problem with a linear theory of time?
Well, first, it's certainly valuable to think time in a linear way. I won't deny the value of doing so. And one obvious advantage to do so is that it helps us to simplify our life and also the way events take place in time. By understanding time according to a principle of successive instant from past to present to future, we can feel a sense of control over time, and we can also have this kind of clear cut between different temporal categories and put everything in one of them. But the key problem, however, in that we somehow constructed a false equivalence between individuals' private time and the time of the world without realizing that the interaction between the subject and the structure often involves the tension between different temporal dimensions, not just our private sense of past, present, and future. For example, a subject does not self-determine its own identity based on how he himself create a narrative of his past. Instead, there are many constraints imposed upon subjects by a wilder outside temporal structures not under his control. In this sense, to reject a linear theory of time is to help us better understand the existential meaning of living both individually and collectively.
Okay, that's a really helpful. And so one of the, I think, innovations of the book is you argue that thinking about time alongside Lacan, we can kind of categorize time within his three registers of the imaginary, mm-hmm. the symbolic, and the real. Could you explain a bit how you define those three aspects of time? And just keeping in mind our listeners, some of whom are very familiar with Lacan, others not at all. So as much as you can, if you can try and do it in a way that is friendly to people who might not know too much about Lacan's three registers.
Yeah, of course, I'll try my best. I think my idea is also the major argument of my books is to say that there are multiple temporal registers in Lacan's work, and also these temporal registers has effects on our everyday life. So we should not only understand time as a private or personal experience of the past, present, and future, but to see how the interactions between different temporal dimensions can form more complex pictures of the living of human beings. The most obvious ones, or the ones that everyone can easily get access to, is what I call the imaginary time. It's what our conscious interpretation of the temporal flow looks like. So it often appears in terms of the past, present, future, in terms of what happens before and what happens after. So this time is the time through which we construct our imaginary ego, and it also gives coherence to our identity during its formation. So we can produce a self-narrative about what my life was and what I become, who I am at this moment. But there are also two other temporal registers that are not easily consciously experienced. One, I would argue, is the symbolic time. It's a temporal order deprived of subjectivity, which means that it's not under my own control, and I cannot easily identify what is the past, what is the future in these temporal registers. It's a temporal flow in its social, cultural, or political dimensions, and it imposes its own constraints upon the individual. It heavily influences our life trajectory, but one cannot easily subvert it, or one cannot easily escape from it. So I argue that this temporal register is one in which the uncertainty of our life originates, and it's also gives us some sense of time that we need to always struggle to get meaning out of it. The third dimension, which I call the real time, is experienced by the subject in momentary decisions and actions. I would say the time of the event that disrupts our sense of the self-control, and it also suspends the overdetermination of the symbolic time. Real time does not always comes to our consciousness, but nor does it comes from nowhere. It's my argument that it has a solid bodily origin, so it's related to how our body processes time. But it also reveals us the significance of how time is embodied by ourselves.
Hmm. I wonder if I could ask you methodologically how you kind of managed to come up with this quite innovative reading of Lacan, because we're all, I guess, it's well known that Lacan has these categories of the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real, but I don't think anyone has kind of split up time in this way in particular. So how did you actually, what was your working process like, and what led you to this way of reading time in Lacan's work?
I think the way I write my book somehow reflects the way I think of the whole notion of time in Lacan's work. In both process, I started with this paper, Lacan's Logical Time Essay. I think it's a key paper in Lacan's early stages, where he focuses exclusively on how the time can interact with our logical thinking and maybe become a part of our logic. By analyzing and close reading this paper, I come to realize there are some tensions or some contradictions in Lacan's writing that show me a path to the idea of multiple temporal registers. So I think the idea I put forward is to a solution that can solve some existing problems in Lacan's work. So I try to further develop it and find more evidence in Lacan's other writings and use it to in this kind of dialectic ways that both to analyze Lacan's work and use Lacan's work to support my argument.
Okay. And so, yeah, let's go into this first chapter of the book on logical time, because as you say, it kind of underpins, I think, the arguments throughout the entire book. So could you give us some kind of summary of what the main argument is in your reading of logical time?
Well, actually, Lacan's this paper is quite complicated because it's involves solving a logical puzzle, which is this three prisoner puzzles. So it's kind of a close step-by-step analysis of his reasoning process and how I develop my own. But to put it simply here, I think we are trying to deal with a puzzle in which prisoners need to identify their own identities in the form of the color of the disc they are carrying around. So there are, in the original game, there are like 5 discs, 3 in white and 2 in black, and each prisoner can only see the disc of the others. And so the key point Lacan wants to make is that time can become a logical component of one's reasoning process, because whether one comes to the right or correct conclusion depends on how long the other two have spent thinking and the exact time the others started to make decision and start to move. And so the prisoner are not just thinking in time, they are thinking by including time into their logical process.
Mm.
And Lacan's perfect solution to this puzzle is that there must be a moment of hesitation and a moment of haste required for the prisoner to come to the final conclusion. But my reading challenges whether these temporal experiences are really necessary for the structuration of logical time. My argument instead is that Lacan's solution to the puzzle relies on an assumption, which is the absolute reciprocity between these three prisoners, so that each prisoner can see the other as the mirror image of himself and put himself in the other's shoes, which this kind of reciprocity for me is rather a fantasy of the real interhuman relations in our actual life. And if we follow Lacan's...
Yeah, This bit, you said you take very seriously the idea that the prisoner can be stupid or the prisoner can be much smarter than you, that we shouldn't assume that the prisoners are mirror images of ourselves.
Oh, yeah, that's right? True. Yeah, I think that's how in the real world a human interacts with each other, because they are actually a sense of otherness between one and another, and everyone don't assume that they can totally understand their fellow beings. But in this three prisoner problem, in order to come up with Lacan's perfect solution, we have to simplify the human relation, which I find is maybe quite problematic. And if we also follow Lacan's later work that introduce more complexities such as sense of otherness into the idea of intersubjectivity, we should see that the tension between a logical process and a spontaneous temporal experience are already quite evident. So this is actually the foundation upon which I introduced the idea of multiple temporal registers.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I mean, I remember when I was reading the Logical Time essay, thinking how almost un-Lacanian it was that he kind of required us to postulate this idea that we could assume that all of the prisoners had the same level of intelligence, because it seems so fundamental to a Lacanian way of thinking, precisely as you said, to understand, to consider that the other has something other about them that we can't access.
Yes.
Just to stay with this chapter for a minute or two longer, so what exactly is the tension between real and symbolic time that you kind of identify in this essay?
Well, in this part, I try to give the idea of symbolic time and real time some very concrete forms. For me, the symbolic time appears in the three prisoner puzzle as this logical reasoning sequence that starts from a moment of instant observation and moves on to the process of reasoning, and then end with a moment of concluding. So this is a reasoning process or sequence validated only by the big other, which is the warden of the prison. So the prisoner can only participate in this alienating temporal movement step by step in order to have his own identity recognized by the other. Real time, on the other hand, does not subordinate to this symbolic order or to this logical articulation. It's the very moment the individual or the prisoner comes to realize that I have to make a decision by myself to determine who I am or what the color of my disc is. So it's a kind of create a founding moment for the subject to self-determinate and thus to disrupt the rule that governs his existence. And the tension between the real and the symbolic time is a very tension between the moment of freedom and the time of the law. So this opposition, I believe, not only appears in this logical time essay or in Lacan's early work, I also demonstrate in my book that it's a very important theme in Lacan's work that will reappear in many other seminars or in many other writings as well.
So if I understand correctly, what you're saying is there's a way of understanding a kind of prisoner's dilemma where you could think of it solely in terms of the rules of the game and the what you call the law, and that would be a kind of symbolic time. And then there's this separate question of the subject making a decision outside of those rules, and that's the real time. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so... Moving on to chapter two, which you call real time, this is where you really flesh out your notion of this of what you call real time. And I found it very interesting that here you decided to look at Freud's metapsychology and kind of examine some of the aspects of Freud that people, I suppose, sometimes feel a bit embarrassed about, because it's Freud dealing with kind of sort of some biological notions that have since been discredited. So why were you drawn to Freud's metapsychology in this chapter, and what were you trying to do with it?
Well, after this first chapter on logical time, I think what I want to do next is to have a more comprehensive examination of real time and symbolic time respectively. And real time, in my understanding, is deeply related to subjects' ethical choices, the emergence of an event and the possibility of freedom against temporal constraints. So I need to find an ontological foundation that makes this real time possible. My reading and analysis leads me to the idea of real body in Lacan's writing and then to Freud metapsychology, which offers a quite interesting psychological account of the body process. Although a lot of people will feel that Freud's original account is not scientifically valid enough, it's not really a theory of biology, but I think even Lacan would agree with that argument that we shouldn't simply interpret it in terms of biology, but rather in terms of analogy between our biological process and our mental activities. So it's more like a philosophical inquiries that using some biological metaphors as an example. Mm-hmm. And I think it still has its philosophical meanings at the current moment.
Mm. So what is bodily time?
When we speak of time, I think we mostly think of our time consciousness, which is how we consciously perceive and experience time. So, mm-hmm. But what we often overlook is that our body or the organism is also in constant flux. It also experiences changes in both the external and the internal environment. So time not only perceived by our mind, it also perceived by body, and it is reflected in the body rhythm. So how does this fundamental organic sense of time give rise to our temporal consciousness? And how does a human subject move from this bodily passive perception of time to a subjective understanding of time? I think these are quite important problems we need to ask if we want to truly understand the body-mind problem and to understand how the subjects interact and perform his agency in a more embodied way. So my understanding of body time is that it's not relied on the body as a biologically determined entity, nor is it simply a blank surface that can be reshaped and configured by maybe cultural forces or social forces. Instead, I understand it in terms of a body machine, which is outside of what is being symbolized, but it can passively or perpetually receive and disseminate bodily tensions or excitations in a way that helps us to define or resist our imaginary ego's manipulation of our body image. So our ego may create what we see a coherent body, a unified image, but our body may not really agree with it. It has its own movement, its own tensions, and it produces its own demand. So there are this kind of time difference between how we imaginary perceive time and how the body process time. And this difference for me may be a foundation that helps us to understand the possibility of freedom that transcends this ego holistic individuals and conditions an act of liberation from our imagined temporal order.
Mm, that's really interesting. Could you say a bit more about how that enables us to think of an idea of freedom? Because I guess my immediate reaction mm-hmm. would be to think if the body is kind of just receiving excitations, then what about that has to do with freedom? It sounds like a potentially very passive experience.
Well, I think it's passive in a way that it's passively doing some active things at the same time. So because let's go back to our imaginary time or what I say, call our consciously experienced time, we often construct this idea of past, present, and the future in this kind of linear ways. But what really is the future? We always say that the future equals some kind of openness or some kind of freedom that is waiting for the subject in a like a very far away horizon. But the idea of future in the conscious often require this kind of delays or waiting the sonnet, the future can never be really actualized. It's always something that past the present, but not present. But in terms of the bodily time, I would say the past, present, and future are all converted into a same temporal horizons. They are in each other. Or we should say that there is a future in present, or there is a past in present. And in Freudian or in Lacanian psychoanalysis, I find the idea of real or future are primarily presented in the idea of death drive. It's kind of openly conventionally interpreted as destructive forces, but for me it's rather a liberating forces, because it helps us to destruct the ego's binding of the energy and producing some disruptive ways for the subject to open itself towards the future, but not waiting for the future. So there is some action always going on in the body that lead the subject to a sense of freedom.
So it's something about the way that the body can challenge the ego's attempt to have a coherent understanding.
Yes, that's the basic logic. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, I felt when I was reading this book, it's I guess it kind of proves your point in a way. It's such a challenge to constantly hold in mind that there are all of these different experiences of time that we're not conscious of, and perhaps our conscious ego even tries to refuse acknowledging.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so it takes a lot of kind of mental fortitude in a way, or maybe openness. I'm not sure what the right term is, in order to accept that all of these different registers of time are at some level being experienced, but you know, are hard to conceptualize. Okay, let's look at the following chapter on symbolic time. And here I was interested in your exploration of Freud's claim that the unconscious is timeless. And you said that we can't really take this statement at face value. So what's the problem with thinking about the unconscious as timeless?
Well, the problem is actually what is the meaning of timeless? So there are, I think, different ways of understanding these notions. Conventionally speaking, or from most of the commentators of Freud, they would understand timeless as permanence, or to simply put, it's forever the same, something that always staying in the same place and has kind of determining effect on all the later events. In Freud's work, we can see this time timeless in terms of the infantile wishes and infantile experience, that even in adult dreams, we often find the determining forces that coming from our very early life stages. So Freud may believe that these are what we call the timeless content. But I think there are a lot of problems in this kind of interpretation, because it somehow contradicts with other characterizations of consciousness, even in Freud's own work. For example, Freud argues that the unconscious is dominated by the primary process, which is this kind of mental activities that will instantly discharge excitations and tensions without holding them. But how is it that the unconscious can perceive unsatisfied wishes in order for them to become timeless if they are only dominated by primary process? So these two arguments kind of contradict with each other. So that's why I think the second reading comes, which is to say that timelessness should be understood not as the absolute absence of time, but rather a different time, which is not to be confused with our everyday conception of, or our everyday consciousness of time. So what timelessness denies is not the existence of time, but rather our imaginary construction of time. It introduces different time registers, very much separated from our inner time consciousness, one that manifests itself to the subject as a radical sense of otherness.
Mm-hmm. And is this what you would refer to as symbolic time?
Yes, that's true. It's the foundational moment that introduced some basic idea of symbolic time, but the most other aspect of symbolic time will be developed by Lacan himself.
Mm-hmm. So it seemed in this chapter, one of the things I noticed was a kind of that you were implicitly maybe challenging the way that some psychoanalysts might focus on early childhood. What do you think is the problem with thinking about things in these terms?
Well, I don't think I'm the first one to challenge this kind of assumptions on the importance of early childhood memories. In fact, in psychoanalytic literatures, there has already been a lot of debate around these notions and whether it's still clinically useful in today's therapy and practice. But what I did is to introduce a more theoretical or a temporal perspective that rejects these assumptions and replace it with a more useful or relevant ideas. So, maybe empirically speaking, I think this childhood memory, to say that they determine all our adult dreams, or to say that they determine all the symptom formation for the adult, lacks empirical evidence according to contemporary neuro and cognitive science studies. But even in Freud's own work, we can see that this kind of childhood determination memories, they will require the existence of a class of fantasy, which the theory of mind cannot permit to exist in terms of what I mentioned earlier, the secondary process and the primary process. There is this kind of contradiction to say whether one can really hold or reserve these memories without the involvement of the ego. So if unconscious is truly time, we shouldn't really prioritize childhood memory simply because they happen earlier or they are some older memories, all which is, theoretically speaking, should be of equal importance and equal powers. And even in Freud's some case studies, for example, the dreams of the Ehlmer's injections, he didn't really find those early childhood wishes, but simply some recent wishes related to recent events. So that may also prove the idea of early childhood memories may not be as important as we believe.
And do you think, does this connect in some way then to the concept of symbolic time, or does symbolic time help us understand how we can overcome this focus on childhood memories?
I think that's true, because by giving up the idea of early childhood memory, not seeing it as the only determining factors that determines our symptom formation, we actually opens up quite a lot of space to think the other factors or other dimensions of time that can provide us with different resources for us to do dream interpretation or do analysis of the symptoms. The symbolic time stands for what articulated in the symbolic chain outside of the individual consciousness. So it involves a lot of political, social, cultural articulations in the background, but they always has a very indirect influence on how we experience ourselves and how we perceive ourselves. So they kind of gave us this kind of externally located knowledge that is very much related to some symptom we will form in our later years. And I think that many therapists now start to look at these connections, to look at the historical or social background, not just one's family dramas, so to have a better understanding of one's the whole life history or how he developed the development from his early to the current stages.
That kind of connects to my final question about this chapter, which is, I know this is not, your book was not written as a kind of, offering suggestions on technique for practitioners, but mm-hmm. I was wondering if these ideas gave you, if you have anything in mind about what implications this might have for clinical psychoanalytic technique.
Yes, my book is not theoretically oriented, but when I'm writing these chapters, I think I have, I do hope to have some more conversations with therapists or with practitioners in terms of how the time can be understood in the clinical settings and if we can try to comprehend those different temporal dimensions and use them to help the patient to understand themselves. So my idea of symbolic time is to introduce this externally located knowledge or some knowledge that's produced outside of our life but has a direct relevance to our beings. So I think how to convert these kind of notions into some techniques can be a quite interesting research of the direction of research that will lead to some further project.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just thinking in particular, because we were speaking about, childhood memories, that I guess, given that you say that, suggest that this shouldn't be, one shouldn't focus too much on childhood memories as the necessary source of unraveling all the symptoms, that it might shift the way that clinicians, might organize the way they ask questions, for example.
Yes. I think it's more like whether one can be more constructively informed to use the notion of social construction, so maybe cultural or historical interpretations to comprehend a more complex pictures of one's life, not just reducing an individual to the shadow of his early childhood struggles. So it may help us understand more of the social origins of the symptom. Yes.
Yeah, it just occurred to me as you were saying that this might also be something of an answer to the kind of work by post-colonial and critical race kind of psychoanalytic critics who say that, psychoanalysis needs to incorporate the wider social history of a subject instead of just their kind of individual life history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so moving on to your chapter on symptomatic time, it's a great term, symptomatic time. Could you just tell us what is symptomatic time?
Well, symptomatic time is not as the three temporal registers we have discussed earlier. It does not designate a particularly temporal process, but rather indicates how the symptom and the subject's temporal brains share a similar characters in its formation. So they both need some kind of a compromise formation in which opposite or contradicting tendencies are contested with each other and find their partial expressions through this temporal formation. So it's a term that I use to understand the subject's formation.
Mm-hmm. And in this chapter, you explore the way that Freud tries to find a kind of potentially phylogenetic origin for the subject or for symptoms. So what are you trying to do here, and why are you exploring this question of Freud's search for an origin?
So in order to answer the question about subject formation, we always go back to the kind of original moment. But what does this original moment mean in time? I think there are a lot of debate, and the most famous one is in the psychoanalysis, the debate between Freud and Rank in terms of whether the origin is early childhood trauma that actually happened, or the Oedipus complex that retrospectively projects a fantasy back to the origin.
So this is kind of the debate between...
Yeah, so this is a debate that I use as the background of my discussion, because I think that there is a crucial problem in both of these two thinkers' argument is to reduce time to this kind of linear notions. They both try to find this kind of original location, whether it's actually happened or it's just imaginarily constructed. But I see the origin not as a single moment, but rather as a mechanism that keeps happening, or it's an ongoing process that will persist into our adult life. So it's an origin where we always convert our real body demand into the symbolic representations. So this is what I see as the origin.
So is that almost like a constantly reoccurring origin?
Yes, that's true. So it's just to reject the myth of origin as the earliest or as the only things that must happen in one's life, but to see it as a mechanism or as a process that happens between different temporal registers, not within one temporal movement. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I was very amused to see that in this chapter also you worked a bit with Jean Laplanche, and I guess I found it funny because I think I did something a bit similar in my own thesis, where I mostly deployed a kind of Lacanian framework, and then there was a moment when I thought it was very important to go into the work of Laplanche. So could you say what were you doing here? You were working with the concept of the enigmatic signifier. So what did you gain from this idea, and also what was your kind of criticism of it?
Well, I go to Laplanche's idea is because I find that he offers a lot of interesting point related to our understanding of how the symbolics influence individuals. So in Laplanche, in his reading of Freud, he also, like Lacan, criticized Freud's tendency to reduce the origin to an exclusively biological moment. So he rebuilt this kind of theoretical connection between the primal seduction and the primal repressions, not in the sense of conforming the happening of an actual seduction, but to introduce the idea of otherness in the formation of subjectivity. In his argument, he suggests that the early child-parent relations, there must be some enigmatic message coming from the parent that cannot be totally processed or assimilated by the child. Instead, these messages become some alienating factors that externally determines the subject's own internal psychic structures. It's this otherness embedded in the enigmatic message that produces a destabilizing effect. So both Laplanche and Lacan reject the idea of biological origin, and they both argue that infantile development is immersed in the symbolic world. But what differentiates Lacan from Laplanche, or what differentiates my reading of Lacan, is that Laplanche still insists on the role of the small other, which is the real actual parenting and how they transmit the enigmatic signifier to the child. So it's still an episode in the early childhood memory. It's still one moment and one event. But for Lacan, what he emphasizes is the whole idea of the big other and the involving process of the signifying chain. So it's a constant influence. It's always happening at different stages of one's life. The second difference is that Lacan somehow gives this kind of more active role to the individual in his interaction with the symbolic world. So the infant or the subject is no longer just a passive recipient of this signifiers, but he may actively invest his own energies or his own instinctual drives into an outward signifiers to develop this kind of connection between the symbolic and himself. So to have himself represented by another object and to engage in the world in a more active way. So this is what I think maybe Laplanche's reading is lacking.
Yeah, it reminds me of somewhere Alenka Zupančič writes about a step that Laplanche might miss, where the child is receiving this enigmatic message, and for Laplanche, the message contains some kind of meaning that the child tries to decipher. And Zupančič kind of says that before this happens, there has to be that the child posits the idea that something means, that the very idea of meaning itself is a kind of subjective moment that maybe Laplanche leaves out in his narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to make sure we have some time to discuss the final chapter of your book called Sext Time, because I thought this was a really unique chapter. So could you tell us a bit about how this came about? I noticed that in this one you kind of engaged with some feminist and queer theory.
Well, I also consider this chapter maybe the most important one in my book. I kind of regard all the previous chapters as theoretical preparations, and this chapter as the final moment when everything comes to fruition. Because personally, I have a long-standing interest in gender theories and in queer theories as well. And since I started to read Psychoanalysis, I noticed this tension between the insistence of a dualistic framework of sexual difference in Freudian Lacanian psychoanalysis, and the various social construction of gender and sexual plantations in gender and queer theories. So this is a very strong tension or contradiction that persisted from the Freudian time to contemporary societies. So I want to find a kind of solution or a way to will help us find a compromise formation between those different tendencies. And for me, the previous Lacanian response to these problems is not really satisfying. Many Lacanian psychoanalysts believe that Lacan's theory of sexuation has already escaped the pitfalls of Freudian psychoanalysis. It's no longer phallocentric because Lacan emphasize the idea of symbolic, not just the biological body. But I want to demonstrate in this chapter that in so far as a new temporal perspective has not been introduced, the previous solution is not enough for us to really save Lacan from those phallocentric accusations. Lacan's work on this topic has not really been interpreted in a way that can sufficiently respond to the complexities of contemporary issues around gender identities. And my intention is not to make another ontological claim about what sexuality is or what gender is, but I want to offer a new epistemological model that permits a more tolerant understanding of the experience of being sex or being gendered.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with first, why do you think that the so far the answers that Lacanian practitioners and scholars have offered to the question of gender construction and sexuality, why have the answers so far been insufficient? And then maybe you could say a bit about what different way of approaching the question you offer.
Mm-hmm. So first we may look at what progress Lacanians psychoanalysis has made in comparing to the Freud's original argument. So I think Lacan has provided a quite strong defense of the value of sexual difference. For example, Lacan would argue that men and women are merely signifiers that related to the use of language, not really to our bodily difference. And there are a lot of different factors need to be considered when we talk about sexual identification and how the desires are determined through the negotiation between drive and the law in the constitution of the subject. On the other hand, Lacan also makes the point very clear that the symbolic difference is this kind of real difference, so it cannot be easily symbolized to our popular understanding of what man is, what woman is. Sex difference function as the limit of signification, and it forces every subject to confront this inherent antagonism. So what's wrong with this theory? I think there are maybe two major issues. One is that it still does not solve the problem of failures, and it does not truly explain why failures is still determined to different sexual positions. Even it's argued that failures is only articulated at a symbolic level, I think we all can agree that this idea cannot be completely disassociated from the penis or from its biological functions. By insisting that the relation between sex continue to be indicated by referring to the phallic function, I think we are returning to the symbolization of the anatomical sexual difference and not really moving to a different level.
Mm-hmm. Also, and in Lacan's... accepting, mm-hmm. I guess, a bit of Judith Butler's kind of criticism
I think, but I also recognize the real difference in Lacan's work, which I think maybe Judith Butler didn't really. I think she used social contractions to replace this kind of real sexual difference. But in Lacan, even we recognize that yes, there are real sexual difference, but how it represents itself in our everyday, maybe gender and sexual identifications, it's not clear if we don't understand it from a temporal perspective. So this is why in the original graph of sexuation in Seminar 20 in Lacan's work, we still see this kind of two opposite positions, one is feminine position and one is masculine position. No matter how we interpret this formula, I think we are still trapped by this kind of spatial differentiation between one space which occupied by a phallus, the other space which lacks this kind of signifier, lacks a very determining moment, determining factors. So this spatial arrangement still can still originate from Freud's original argument, having or not having the penis. It's just converted into a more symbolic level, having or not having the feathers. So I think to destruct this kind of framework, we need to totally change our perceptions of how time and space functions.
Right, yeah. So how does a temporal reading help us overcome some of these problems then?
I think by introducing a temporal perspective, I want to change, first to change the job of psychoanalysis in terms of dealing with sexuation, dealing with sexual identities. So I argue it's not the job of psychoanalysis to tell us what gender is or what sexuality is. Since this kind of personal gender identity always depend on the complex negotiation between one's own body desire and the social cultural context. So any attempt to offer this kind of transcendental masculine or feminine position is always oversimplified and misleading. Psychoanalysis, on the other hand, can offer us an understanding of becoming a sex subject. So it can ask this question, which is through what kind of process does a sex body become symbolically representable, if only in an incomplete sense. So it sits at a neutral ground, but the question is the way an individual becomes a sex being. And this process actually is may lead to two different solutions. One is a masculine reading and one is a feminine reading. So this masculine feminine, which applied here, does not mean some ontological body, but means two kind of epistemological approaches to one unified process of being sex.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit, I know it's a quite complex argument that you make, but could you say a little bit about what these two types of processes are then?
Yes, so I think to make my argument, I started with Freud's test, and I go back to Freud's idea of the primal view, which is for me it's a kind of overlooked idea in Freud's work, because we all understand, we all know about the Freud work of primal scene, which is the moment the infant see the parent's sexual intercourse and become traumatized. But a few people realize that Freud also gives us a picture of how the boys and girls see the other partner's genital or area and become realized of their sexual difference. And this is a very interesting moment for me, is that Freud argues in his 1925 paper that the little boy who catches the sight of the girl's genital regions only makes sense of what he found retrospectively, that after many years, but a girl will make her judgment at that very moment. So there is already a temporal difference at this primal view, which defines sexual difference not in terms of having or not having a penis, but in terms of how the knowledge of sexual difference generated. So this is where I think that the epistemology of sex subjectivity can be differentiated, and there are actually two ways of understanding how one becomes a sex being. One is from this kind of masculine way to say that the phallus is always there and we retrospectively becomes who we are. The other is following maybe Lacan's idea of the future anterior to say that we will have become this kind of sex being, and the phallus or this kind of biological determining factor is only a moment that will be surpassed in our progress or in our development.
So the masculine way of becoming, you're saying, is this kind of retrospective realization of the
absence. I think the masculine way is a kind of confirms not kind of sociological normativity to that will ultimately place an individual either in a masculine position or as a feminine position. But the other way is help us to promote a more tolerant or more opening perspective to deal with this kind of very uncertain character of sexuality itself, and to accommodate more viable sexual arrangement.
So how is it, I'm just trying to work my way through, so how is it that the idea that the in Freud's narrative, the little girl instantly recognizes that she's deprived of the phallus, how does that lead you to theorizing this notion of the future anterior and as something that's more open?
I think these are quite complicated reasoning process in my book, but I want to maybe try to explain a little bit here. I think it's based or built upon my discussion of the dialectic movement between the real time and the symbolic time. One is to see the body's matrix, how it works in its own way. The other is to see how the symbolic produce its own articulation of personal identity and how it determines one's life trajectory. So in this particular case, in this case of sexuation, by arguing that the girl can reach its conclusion instant, it doesn't mean the girl instantly realizes she is lacking something, because if she doesn't be determined by the symbolic ideas about why phallus is important, she won't be able to realize that she is lacking the phallus. She just realized that there is a blank space, right? So I think this leads us to a conclusion that her argument at that point is rather she will have lacked something. So this thing is postponed to the future, not really realized in the present moment. So this, I will have like something is a belief, but it's not a conviction. So it's reduce this masculine body part to a single moment not lost in one's process of development. And when the girl grew up, he already overcome that difficulties. And she moves from what I will have become to what I will become. So it's there is this kind of step-by-step reasoning.
Okay, thank you for breaking that down, because I know it is a very complicated part of the book, but I think it's also very crucial for people to get a flavor of what you talk about here, because it's quite interesting and important. Just another kind of follow-up question on this. Does the conclusion that you reach then, these two different ways of kind of becoming sexed, are we talking in kind of ontological terms, like there's a masculine way and there's a feminine way, and people will follow one or the other, and that's kind of fixed in them, or is there some kind of movement between one and the other?
I think so. By the end of my book, I no longer argues about any dualistic framework of sexual difference. So I no longer use this kind of masculine or feminine language to describe what sexuality is, but I still use those kind of vocabulary to help us to understand our way of thinking about sexual difference. So there is still this kind of traditional masculine way to think about sexual difference that will ultimately lead to our very fixed idea of what man is, what woman is. But there is also a more open way to think that may work alongside with feminist and queer theory to promote ways that help us accommodate different sexual arrangement and encourage some more fluid sexual identity constructions based on one's own subjectivities, I think.
Just a final question on this. It seems to me, this comes up over and over again. Do you, in kind of discussions about psychoanalysis, do you think that this reading kind of, you know, there's a very common objection to the fact that in the Lacanian version of psychoanalysis, sexual difference is the kind of constitutive moment of subjectivity. And I think a lot of critics say, why is it that male and female are given this kind of import over all of these other potentially constitutive aspects of who we are? Do you think that this reading helps to unravel that a bit?
Probably, yes, I guess, because I think I still agree with Lacan, and I still follow this principle that the sexual difference is a real difference. It's the founding difference of human sexuality. But I say it because of the reason sexuality involves how our body interacts with the symbolic, and it's a very, very good cases to see how our body or how our instincts, how our desire and drive are incorporated into our identity formations. So I think sexual difference in this sense is still relevant, but I will no longer understand the sexual difference as a difference between men and women or between masculinity and femininity, but rather the difference as this kind of internal struggles of within one's body that one always find something different or something wrong with how I experience my own drive or my own desires. So this is, I think, a unique case for each individual to how to find peace with his or her own body and reaches an identification that can connect the body with the symbolic.
That's very helpful. So I guess, could you say then that you've made the difference between sexual difference and gender a lot clearer, to say that this is really not a process we should understand in terms of gender?
I think it's related to the gender in the sense that it will help us to understand gender identifications But it will not reduce gender to fix dualistic or binary configurations.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for exploring this with me. I mean, as you can probably tell, I have a lot of my own kind of personal academic interest in this subject. Really helpful to hear your take on this. Okay, so we have gone over time. So just to ask you the final question we always ask on the podcast, what are you working on at the moment?
Well, currently I'm working on a postdoctoral project concerning the idea of consciousness in French modern intellectual histories, including Lacan, Deleuze, and Merleau-Ponty. I want to produce maybe psychoanalytically informed philosophical answer to this kind of the question of what consciousness is and how consciousness is related to our body. Since we all know that this kind of research has been quite popular in the analytic philosophy and in this kind of philosophy of mind, but there is a lack of research in the continental traditions, so I hope to bridge this gap by bringing psychoanalysis into the picture.
Great, that sounds really fascinating. So Chen Yang, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on the show and also to begin this new series on psychoanalysis and time.
Yeah, thank you as well.